From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, workers in the state's construction and fishing industries are many times more likely to die from an opioid overdose than in other industries. A new report explains why and what can be done.
Ambulances don't go where fishermen fish, and it's only been very recently that the Coast Guard has been allowed to carry Narcan, which reverses opioid overdoses.
Also today, the legislature, judiciary, and governor's office are all exempt from state public records laws. Is it time for that to change? Plus, Juul Labs pushes back against allegations that it markets e-cigarettes to kids. And it's shark season off the Cape, where a great white jumped right out of the water under the feet of the state's premier shark researcher.
Oh! It jumped right out of the water!
You see that?
Man!
Did you see that?
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In Massachusetts, construction workers die of opioid overdoses at six times the rate of other workers. Fishermen are five times more likely to fatally overdose. That's according to a report out today from the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. And with me now to go through the results of the report is WBUR's Martha Biebinger. Hello, Martha.
Hi, Meghna.
So these sound like some incredible numbers. Break them down for us. What are the biggest findings here?
Well, let's start by noting, Meghna, that it varies by gender for two reasons. More men die after an overdose in general in Massachusetts, and that holds true in the workforce. And also, men and women dominate different industries. So for men, as you said, the opioid overdose death rates are higher among construction, fishing, farming, forestry jobs. And for women, the report highlights healthcare support work and food services.
Interesting. So then why are these particular industries seeing these higher rates?
Well, these jobs are typically lower paid. So the vast majority of the people who died in these reports earned less than $50,000 and many less than $30,000. So those are jobs where there's very little paid sick time. There's little job security, but there are also high rates of injury. So imagine somebody pouring concrete or lifting your grandmother out of a bed. They strain their back. They get a prescription for an opioid, say Vicodin or OxyContin, and they try to numb the pain so they can keep working because they don't have any paid sick time. If the injury doesn't heal, they may become dependent on that pain medication. And in the worst case scenario, they end up addicted and in a fatal overdose. Now, the report doesn't prove each of those connections, but Massachusetts is the first public health agency to report on them and to suggest that they need to continue the analysis and make sure that those links are what's causing the problem.
Right. Okay. So given that possibility of links, you know, what about anything? What about the construction or the fishing industries, in particular, especially on the side for men? Is there anything about the industries themselves that put men at greater risk?
Yes, we'll hear a little bit more about that from Brian Doherty, I think, in just a few minutes, right, Meghna?
Yep,
yeah.
Yep.
And then on the fishing side, here's J.G. Bartlett. He's president of the Fishing Partnership Support Services.
Ambulances don't go where fishermen fish, and it's only been very recently that the Coast Guard has been allowed to carry Narcan, which reverses opioid overdoses.
So you can imagine, like, that's the death rate
right
there. If somebody's in recovery out there on one of those fishing boats, the medications that you need to treat an addiction are buprenorphine and methadone typically, and you often have to start those by going to a clinic every day. How are you going to do that?
Right.
You know, there's a lot of ways that people have a hard time getting away from construction jobs to do those daily checkups with a doctor, or maybe get their urine screens that are needed, the counseling that's needed to go along with that. So there are challenges for blue-collar workers that are just different and maybe make treatment more difficult than they do in many white-collar jobs.
Right. Interesting. So, Martha, you said that this is the first time that the Department of Public Health has done an analysis like this by industry. Why did they want to do that?
Not just the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, Magna, they say that it's the first time a public health agency in the U.S. has
anywhere.
Done it. Yeah.
Okay.
So there was a report out of the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Some independent journalists have tried to look at this, but we're just starting to break down opioid overdose deaths by industry. And Massachusetts said it's important to do because they want to understand what can be done to help prevent this. And it may vary sector by sector. So, for example, the fishing partnership, we just heard from J.J. Bartlett, they're starting to include ergonomic training, teaching you how to stretch before work in their first aid and other CPR.
To prevent injuries that could lead to that series of events you were talking about.
Exactly. Okay. And making sure that people have health insurance so they're getting routine checkups and small things don't turn into something larger that has to be treated with long-term pain medication. The report also says it's important to look at prescribing rates for these injuries. So they have the workers' comp claim data that shows how often people are prescribed opioids. And those rates have dropped, but Massachusetts is still the fifth highest among 26 states they looked at for the dosage that people are given during workers' comp claims.
Interesting. So what does DPH then want to do next with these results?
Well, they're going to work with the CDC on some additional research, that connection that we were talking about earlier. They want to have some stakeholder meetings within these various sectors to figure out what could be done to prevent or assist. Maybe there are some changes in work-related injury rules that would help. And they're going to be with the fishing partnership and other groups on intervention strategies to try to curb this misuse of opioids that seems to be leading to addiction and deaths.
Well, that's WBUR's Martha Biebinger. Martha, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Meghna.
All right. Well, as you heard Martha say, construction workers in Massachusetts have suffered the heaviest losses or the highest rate of deaths from opioid overdoses versus other workers in the state. Workers in the construction and mining industries made up some 24% of all opioid overdose deaths in Massachusetts between 2011 and 2015, amongst workers, I should say. So joining me now is Brian Doherty. He's a general agent at the Building and Construction Trades Council of the Metro District of Greater Boston. They represent 20 local construction unions. Brian Doherty, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you very much for having me.
It's good to have you. First of all, let me just ask you, I mean, have you seen firsthand or amongst your colleagues sort of the effects of what Martha was talking about these higher rates of challenges with opioids and even deaths amongst construction workers?
Yes, we've been seeing it. And that's why when we had the opportunity, we immediately jumped on to help with this research, share best practices, and figure out ways that we can get better at providing the treatment that so much needed by folks experiencing these difficulties.
So tell me more about that. What have you done?
So the building trades unions have had a drug-free workplace. We follow the federal Drug-Free Workplace Act for over 30 years. And what that means, and for a long time, that meant let's make sure that folks aren't using, misusing, or abusing drugs on site. And that was a bit of a preventative measure and sometimes a punitive measure. And for the past, I mean, for decades now, we have taken a more empathetic and compassionate approach, which is this has to be about treatment. This has to be about making sure if workers are experiencing any type of use, misuse, or abuse with any type of dependency on drugs, we have to make sure they have every ability to get back to healthy. So what we want to make sure that is very much communicated today is this has to be figuring out how do we help that person who might be experiencing a difficult time, giving them everything they need, whether it's through our medical our medical funds or our training funds or our health and welfare funds to get the treatment they need to get back to healthy.
Yeah. Can I just ask you, though, I mean, because you heard Martha say a little earlier that there may be just some real significant structural challenges in the nature of the work itself. I mean, I imagine if a construction worker is on a job site, depending on where that job site is, he or she, it might be hard for them to go back and forth between the site and the place where they might need to get treatment. That things like that, that there are needs that the job has that may make it more difficult to get treatment. Is there anything that can be done there?
Yeah, no, I think it's a great question. I think, so we've known this for a long time. Construction is a very dangerous, very difficult job. It is done in all elements of the weather. It is done at extreme heights and temperatures, and again, very difficult work. So it is inherently an industry that at times has unsafe, potentially unsafe situations. So what we've done is we've partnered with all of our healthcare providers and all of our ergonomics experts to figure out what are the safest ways to do this work. And again, just so we understand here, Martha, like this is a This is 100,000 people in Massachusetts. The building trades union represents about 100,000 workers in construction and their entire families, in the sense that we spend over $1 billion on healthcare a year to make sure each worker has the training, the resources, the measures necessary to take on these challenges, to train away so that they aren't in unsafe circumstances, and if an injury or something happens where they might now be in a place where they need some help, that they have every ability to get that help through our modern assistance training programs, our member employee assistance training programs, just to make sure they have the help they need.
Mm. Now, some of the jobs that the report looked at had workers that were earning, you know, less than $50,000 or less. Some of those workers were in construction. And I wonder if there's also an issue of, like, a lot of the jobs can be temporary or contract jobs and maybe don't always include paid sick time. Is that kind of a structural change that the industry overall might consider?
So this is a great question. So the glaring, what we immediately identified in this report was that unionized construction workers had a far better chance of getting back to healthy and in a realistic timeline. They also had a much better chance of not being in a situation where they needed as much help because of the training that goes into it, because of the resources around them if they are experiencing a difficult challenge. So the main takeaway for us was that on the organized side, and in Massachusetts we have a well-organized construction industry, but this, again, we are providing career pathways in the union construction industry to make sure that folks have everything they need for a long, healthy career to support themselves and their families. And the reason I touch on that is because this isn't, we have seen that this isn't a challenge or a public health crisis that discriminates based on socioeconomic backgrounds. This is a public health crisis that is affecting everyone. And the reason we want to step in here is because we've identified some best practices that help, and those best practices are family-sustaining wages, they are health care benefits for the entire family, they are retirement benefits so that worker, after a long, difficult career, has a chance to retire with some dignity. So, yeah, I think that if we can either organize the rest of the industry and provide these union protections to everyone, or figure out ways that we are using these best practices to share them with all workers, that's the best way to handle this, to make sure that they have a complete loop of health, whether they're on the job, off the job, if they have any challenges in front of them. They need the services that should be provided to them, and that's what unions represent here in Massachusetts.
Well, Brian Doherty is a general agent at the Boston Building and Construction Trades Council. They represent some 20 local construction unions. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, really appreciate your time. Thanks for taking on this important conversation.
For those of us attempting to understand the inner workings of the Massachusetts legislature, the big golden dome at the State House can take on a metaphorical feel of something like a giant, utterly opaque brick wall. Transparency? Thy name is not the Great and General Court of Massachusetts. Take, for example, the manner in which the legislature closed its most recent session. Huge, important, potentially game-changing bills about health care and education funding were left to the last minute, pretty much literally, to be hashed out in conference committees that met behind very closed doors. Now, those bills died there. And not only are legislators refusing to be specific as to why the bills died, after years of work for some of these bills, I might add, but because of Massachusetts' abysmal public records laws, the public may never know. Because under current state rules, the governor's office, the state judiciary, and the legislature are exempt from public records laws. Now, there is a legislative committee tasked with exploring whether or not public records laws should be applied to Beacon Hill, but we're still waiting for their report, which was initially due December of last year. So what, if anything, is to be done? Well, joining us now is Mary Connaughton. She's the Director of Government Transparency at the Pioneer Institute. Mary, welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's great to be here, Magna.
So did I sort of describe the workings of Beacon Hill accurately enough?
I think you did a fantastic job, and I don't know if it could be outdone.
Okay. Well, so the education reform bill, the financing reform bill we were talking about in that introduction, was the foundation budget reform bill. We've covered it a lot on this show because it was kind of stunning how, after years of work in the 11th hour, literally, it all fell apart. We won't know why. I mean, what was your reaction to the way that was handled?
It was very surprising that, first of all, that both the House and the Senate had their own bills that they had approved, and it was just in conference committee to iron out the wrinkles in it, and then it was abandoned. Apparently, last minute, more information came to light and was provided by the Department of Education, and it's that information that supposedly stopped the bill where they couldn't agree based upon that new information.
And is literally that information that we cannot gain access to, even though WBR's Edify team has asked repeatedly.
And therein lies a problem. I mean, as the public, we have a right to that information. They work for us, not the other way around.
Okay, so let's take a step back here. Remind us, how is it that this legislature, and again, the governor's office and the judiciary as well, aren't bound by Massachusetts public records laws? I mean, we did have a reform of the rules in 2016.
Right, and the reform just limited to establishing a special committee to look into the issue. But back when the original public records law was written, it excluded the legislature. It said the general court shall not be subject to this law, which is, you know, different from what many other legislatures do, where they do make public information or public records available to the public so the public can do its job and review it.
Now, you have a lot of experience with government. What was the reason they gave us?
Well, they never gave a really good reason for that, but I think part of the reason they said, well, we need, you know, it's more expedient for us to do it this way, and we'll tell you what happened after the fact, but we'll tell you what we think you need to know. More of a parent-child relationship rather than a great government where the public is fully engaged.
So am I hearing this right, though, that the legislature isn't, in the eyes of the law as it's written, it's not considered a public body in the traditional sense?
The legislature is excluded by the virtue of the way the law is written. It said, shall not include the general court.
The irony of this is so powerful because you yourself have pointed out multiple times that the state constitution for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts requires legislative accountability to the people at all times.
At all times, in quotes. So what is going on and are they abiding by the constitution? And one could say that this law that they wrote that excluded them from public records law is actually unconstitutional.
Now, the Pioneer Institute, to be fair, has sort of used this language before. This isn't the first time that you guys have talked about this. Let's just cut to the chase. I mean, if you're saying that it's unconstitutional, the way the public records laws work in Massachusetts right now, when are you guys going to sue?
Well, that's something to consider down the road. Right now, we want to see what happens from this legislative commission and see what they do. But that door is certainly open for us or for other groups. We'd be happy to take a look at partnering with other groups to get that done. But as you stated, they should be accountable to us at all times. The public is supposed to have the right to instruct their legislators. And how can you instruct them if you don't know what they're doing, if they're acting behind closed doors away from the public?
Yeah. Now, there have been other legal challenges regarding different aspects of public records laws in Massachusetts, right? I mean, in 2017, the Attorney General upheld the governor's office's exemption from public records laws.
Right. There was a court case, Lambert versus the Judicial Nominating Committee, back in 1997, and the governor's exemption was because the governor wasn't specifically listed, the governor's office, as being an agency that is held accountable to public records law, they got the exemption from that, and that's the way the court ruled. But that was a court ruling based upon existing statute, not taking it to the constitutional level. So they were just ruling based upon the wording of the statute. So the next step would be to take it to the constitutional level, and that would mean to go to the Supreme Judicial Court and have them take a look at this.
I'm just wondering why you're waiting. Why is Pioneer? I mean, this has been going on for years. Why wait?
Well, we're wanting to see what happens. I mean, it's getting involved and actually carrying it out. There's a lot involved in doing that, but we've been trying to do this, give them the opportunity to do it the right way, and they should see. I mean, we point out our argument very clearly as to why we believe it's unconstitutional. The best means for this to be done would be for them to do it, for them to understand it, because it's about public trust. What an opportunity for the legislature to make this change, to make public records available, to open their doors more for the public. That's a sense of very strong message. And for the Commonwealth, that would be a better way to do it than having to take it to a court of law. And we're hoping that they'll understand, not be shamed into this, but understand that there's a very strong legal argument that they do it.
Yeah, I suppose public shaming isn't the best way to prompt action, but who knows? Things might get desperate. Now, I just want to talk for a second here about this legislative commission that right. is tasked with looking at whether or not changes should be made for on the public records rules and how they apply to the state legislature. Now, it was that was part of the 2016 reform, as mm-hmm. you said. The commission was supposed to initially give a report by December of last year, but mm-hmm. as the Globe reported in November of last year, a month before they were supposed to have this report out, that the commission hadn't even met yet. So they had some fits and starts. They mm-hmm. have subsequently met some four times. There are 14 members of this commission, and their new deadline to issue the report is December of this year.
Yes.
Okay, so that's the timeline it seems like we're waiting for. We've got a couple of statements here from Representative Jennifer Benson and Senator Walter Timilty, who are co-chairing the commission. I just want to read them to you.
Okay.
Representative Benson has said, "We are taking our charge seriously and have been studying how other states treat public records, as well as what the Massachusetts Constitution says on the matter. The commission has received testimony from several organizations and individuals. We expect to receive more at our next meeting in September." And Senator Timilty says, "This is an ongoing process. The committee is committed to providing every effort in order to ensure that all residents of the Commonwealth have the ability to have their voices heard." And then he encourages people to submit comment or come to the public meetings regarding this. Does that give you hope?
Well, it certainly does. I mean, I was at the second meeting and I testified. We had someone else from Pioneer testify at the third meeting. And hopefully at the fourth meeting in September, everyone will be back from their summer breaks, and there'll be a very robust meeting and many groups testifying about the importance of this, because this transparency is key to a healthy democracy, and we just don't have that here. And if we want to go the long haul with this system of government, we have to be more transparent. The public trust is the most important thing, and that has been compromised under the legislature.
So two more quick questions. Massachusetts, by virtually any measure on public records, ranks at or near the bottom
yes.
of these 50 great United States. And, you know, in the statement that I read earlier from Representative Benson, who said they're looking at how other states treat public records. I mean, do you have another state that we should look at and say, like, this is the gold standard?
From what I hear, Florida is very good.
Florida! Yeah.
Alabama has better laws for public transparency than Massachusetts does. So there are many laws, and I mean, it's across the board, there's different treatments of it, of what is a public record and what's not, whether or not the governor's office is excluded. But by far, Massachusetts ranks near rock bottom in that. And this is an opportunity for the legislature to turn that around.
What effect do you think having these exemptions has had on the legislative process in this state?
Well, we don't know if they're abiding by the Constitution's principles if we can't see what they're doing. I mean, if they know that they can do things behind closed doors with impunity because the documents and meetings are never going to be disclosed, what does that say about what we really know that happens? It's not good for the public.
Well, Mary Connaughton is Director of Government Transparency at the Pioneer Institute. Mary, thank you so much.
My pleasure to be here.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It is time to talk about e-cigarettes again, or specifically Juuls. They're those sleek USB flash drive-looking devices that contain very high amounts of nicotine. One Juul pod is about 200 puffs, about the equivalent of smoking a pack of cigarettes. Moreover, they are hugely popular amongst young people. Now, Juul Labs Incorporated, which makes up about 60% of the e-cigarette market, has come under fire from the FDA back this spring, and more recently, Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey, for not doing enough to curb underage use and actually promoting their products, according to Healey and the FDA, promoting their products to teenagers. So, part of Juul's answer to these repeated accusations of marketing to minors? Well, they've got a print and radio marketing campaign.
Hey, Mike, got a sec? Mom and I want to talk.
Is something wrong?
We just want to help you make the right decisions. It's this vaping thing.
I'm not... Just hear us out, all right? We want to make sure you know everything.
You've probably already heard of vaping and have some information about it. And we know that some of it can be confusing. We also understand that as parents, you're concerned. So maybe some facts will help.
facts about this vaping thing. Well, joining me now, I shouldn't laugh, this is serious, but joining me now is John Carroll, Boston University Professor of Journalism and WBUR Senior News Analyst. Hello, John.
Hello, Meghna.
I'm sorry about the laugh, but I think
that's okay. Someone has to do it.
It just shows how possibly ineffective this campaign's going to be. But why the sudden push against underage smoking by Juul Labs? What's actually going on here?
Well, what's actually going on is there are all these lawsuits flying around. There are investigations like Maura Healey's. The FDA is cracking down on Juul. I mean, they're under the microscope at this point. So what they do is they say, immediately, we're going to go out and do public outreach. So the day after the FDA said, we're cracking down on Juul, They committed $30 million over 3 years to a public engagement program. And part of it is these advertisements. So what they're doing is trying to basically soften the broadsides that are coming from two lawsuits in California, one in New York, Maura Healey's investigation, the FDA crackdown. I mean, They're getting beaten to death by croutons here.
Well, you know, I mean, but there is a rising chorus of concern from public health officials. I mean, we spoke with Jonathan Winnikoff here on Radio Boston back in June, and he is a former chair of the American Academy of Pediatrics Tobacco Consortium. And just as a sense of what he said Juul is already a massive public health disaster. That was his take. Because of its huge popularity amongst young people, teens and even middle schoolers. So you mentioned Maura Healey's investigation that she launched late last month. And I just want to play a little tape here. Here's Attorney General Healey in July when she was announcing what's going on.
My message is pretty simple. Stop selling this stuff to young people. It's a matter of public health and it's a matter of public safety. And I want it to end.
But, John, so let me ask you, though, what's actually the intent of these ads from Juul, though? Is it public information? Is it to get kids to stop using it? I mean, what?
It's damage control. Basically, they're trying to go out there and counter the bad press they're getting with some message that's positive, showing themselves to be good public citizens. I mean, Juul, I'll give you two facts that give you some sense of how popular Juul is. For one thing, it's a verb now. Once you get verbified, you know, you're pretty much embedded in the culture. The other is 2016 Surgeon General report said that over the course of 4 years, high schoolers were increasing e-cigarette use by 900%. So this is something that's really galloping away, especially in high schools. You walk into a high school bathroom and all you smell is cucumber, creme brulee, and mint or mango.
Well, I mean, the very flavors themselves, a lot of people say that shows that they're marketing to teens because of, you know, creme brulee. Maybe adults like creme brulee vaping. I don't know. But we have a little bit more of one of the radio ads from Juul, so let's listen to that.
While we believe vaping can be a viable alternative for adult smokers, these products still contain nicotine, which is addictive. Juul is designed to be an alternative for adult cigarette smokers. This means that Juul is not for kids. But many kids try to fit in or feel pressured by their friends to try vapor products. Facts are the best defense.
Okay, I'm going to give Juul a little credit here and say it seems like the target audience here is parents. Right. But on the other hand, hashtag obvious, kids, as much as I would wish they listen to my beloved medium of the radio or read the newspaper, they do not.
No.
They are on social media. Why isn't Juul putting out these messages on Instagram or Snapchat where, like, all of these kids are always talking about Juul?
They are. They have an Instagram feed that has 44,000 followers, but it's all this kind of stuff, this kind of bromides. I mean, the old cigarettes are for adults, that's the oldest gambit in the tobacco industry playbook. You know, you say that to a 15-year-old, and what's the 15-year-old going to want to do? He's going to want to go do the adult thing. So what's happening is there are two things happening on Instagram. One is these sort of institutional messages from Juul, and the other is these memes out there. Vaping is a much more memeable practice than smoking is. So there was a really interesting piece of The New Yorker a couple of months ago from Gia Tolentino.
It was fantastic.
And she went and talked to a lot of high schoolers, and one of them said, you're expected to Juul, but you're expected not to depend on it. So you Juul, you post about it, it's social, it's ironic, it's funny, and if you get dependent on it, that's when it becomes sad.
But what's Juul supposed to do about that, though? Because, I mean, in their defense, these are teens and kids doing all that free social media marketing on their own. Jewel can just hold its hands up and be like, we're not controlling that.
They can control it. Yeah. But, you know, there's also a black market out there that, you know, there are Jewel dealers in high schools that'll send out on Snapchat, I'll be here at this place at this time, you know, come and buy some pods. So I think that there are all kinds of dynamics going on here that make it hard for Jewel. So they can't control what these kids do. I mean, they've got 44,000 followers. One of these vaping kids has 110,000 followers. And all they do is they scale photos out there that, you know, basically glorify the practice.
Well, so after the Attorney General filed her suit, Jewel sent us to WBUR that said, quote, we have never marketed to anyone underage. In fact, we've done very little marketing relative to our growth. And they went on to say, like many Silicon Valley technology startups, our growth is not the result of marketing, but rather a superior product disrupting an archaic industry.
Sorry to throw numbers at you, but advertising for e-cigarettes in 2011 was $6.4 million. In 2014, it was $115 million. So, I mean, what you have here is an exploding industry that is advertising, but advertising in some subterranean ways, and also has this social media machine working for it, where teens are advertising to teens. And there's no way to stop that, and there's not any real way to counter it either.
Is it? Forgive me for saying this, but this all seems really familiar, a la like the digital age version of the tobacco industry playbook.
Right. And what happened was the tobacco industry made the mistake of trying to go out and advertise. The anti-tobacco people tried to advertise and get people to stop smoking. That doesn't work. But when they went into the schools, you know, that did work. So when the anti-tobacco forces switched from mainstream media to going into schools where there are peer influences, where you're supposed to learn, they had much more success. So
the communications professor saying that that's what ought to be done regarding vaping?
I think the schools would be smart to get on top of this, because otherwise it's going to just keep exploding more and more.
Well, John Carroll is a Boston University professor of journalism. He's also WBUR's senior news analyst. John, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Wednesday means sports. The Red Sox are on a roll. They defeated the Yankees in a 4-game sweep over the weekend, and they appear to be well on their way to completing their first 100-win season since 1946. But I have to say, appear. There's always this hedging with the Sox. So joining us to talk about this and other sports news is WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer. Hello, Shira.
Hello, Magna. I know you were glued to the television for all 4 games, right? Staying up late, catching the extra innings, right?
Me? I was glued to it by way of all the people telling me how amazing the series was. So speaking of which, let's play a little bit of tape here, because on Sunday's game, the Sox stretched into that game into Monday morning, ending with that 5-4 win with, okay, this is where I sound like I know what I'm talking about, Andrew Benintendi's game-winning walk-off in the 10th.
The Yankee right-hander's pitch swung on and a bouncer toward the right center field area. That's through. Here comes Renda. He scores. And Andrew Benintendi sends us home.
Okay, that sounded great. Do you think they will finish the season strong as well?
Yes. And it's really interesting now, because you're getting to the point in the season where they're pulling out all these stats. You mentioned they're on pace to get more than 100 wins for the first time since 1946. And everybody's saying, well, you know, of the teams that had this many wins since 1900, I think it was something like 18, and then 15 of those went to the World Series, and 9 of those won the World Series. So you get all these analytics guys, you know, throwing out numbers about how good this team is going to be. But what you just heard, that walk-off hit in the 10th inning, is why I think there's a lot of reason for hope that this is a World Championship team, a World Series championship team, because they're a resilient bunch. You never ever feel they're out of a game.
This is the opposite of Red Sox fatalism, though.
I know, and that's what's so wonderful about this team. And it's interesting to me, you know, this has now become sort of the character of teams in this city. You had the same sort of feeling about the Celtics too, despite all their injuries this season, that this was a group that had great chemistry and was never out of a game. And you feel in many ways the same way about the Red Sox, albeit on a higher level, because they're having a historic season. But you do feel this great chemistry, this sense that, and it was again last night. I mean, let's not forget, last night they got their 80th win with, I think it was a 5-run 10th inning in Toronto. I mean, they are always one swing away, it seems, from getting back in a game if they're down. And, you know, they're not always down or not often down.
Wow. I'm not sure, like, how is Red Sox Nation supposed to define itself if not through, like, the
through
dark
misery?
Hang cloud of misery? Yeah.
Well, here, I'll give some reality check because playoffs, you know, to be completely cliche, totally different ballgame. And you can't sleep on any of the teams, even in, you know, the American League, whether you're talking about Houston, if the Yankees make it as the wild card, you know, who knows what's going to happen out there, how it's going to shake out. I've heard people talking to me about Cleveland. They're worried about the Athletics, if the Athletics make it in as the wild card. So, listen, there's going to be plenty to worry about okay. come October. You can you know, get white knuckled then.
Good. So everyone, take a deep breath. Pessimism reigns, can still reign supreme.
Yes, I was going to say we got that storm cloud. It'll come back.
But,
don't worry.
But on actually one more serious note about the Sox before we move on to other sports, I just want to talk about Jerry Remy for a minute, facing another major health battle. His sixth time being diagnosed with cancer. I'm just wondering how the Red Sox community are just reacting to this.
Yeah, Nesson made that announcement yesterday that Jerry Remy was once again battling cancer. It's just devastating for Red Sox Nation, for those who follow the Red Sox, for those who enjoy Red Sox broadcasts. I mean, Jerry Remy brings a real life and spirit. He's sort of like the spirit animal of the Red Sox in some way. He's the guy who kind of, you know, just makes you have fun listening to the game. Those broadcasts, especially when they can go from late night into early morning, can be a bit tedious at times when the runs aren't coming in, and Jerry Remy is always there with some levity.
Okay. Well, we wish him all the best as he undergoes treatment again. Let's move on and talk about the Patriots. Their first preseason game kicks off tomorrow against Washington, right?
It's a muted yay because it's preseason. I mean, how can you, with a team like the Patriots, get excited about preseason? This is all about the postseason.
But my question is, scripted here, is what are you getting most excited about?
Okay.
Season.
Well, I'm excited.
The people want to know.
The people want to know. Well, people. I think you get excited to see some of the new players, how they fit in. It's always interesting to see some of the guys who are second and third string, see whether or not they have the stuff to make the team and be real contributors and be impact players. I'm sure we'll get a good long look at backup QB Brian Hoyer. So that's exciting. But really, the real excitement is going to come during the regular season. I'm most curious to see if this seems like there's this brewing soap opera between
Brady. I was going to say the drama.
Exactly, between Brady and Belichick. And what's going to happen there? I mean, they say all the right things. I mean, or if you're Bill Belichick, you really don't say anything. but, you know, where does that go? Is there a crisis point? Is there a tension point in the middle of the season, during the season, if things aren't going well, where things come to a boil? I'm there for the soap opera.
Their
personal
the drama.
Exactly.
All right. But there's some other NFL news that you wanted us to talk about. This is really interesting because former Patriots wide receiver Randy Moss was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame on Saturday, right? Mm-hmm. And he wore a tie to the ceremony that got people talking a bit. What was on that tie?
Well, the tie had the names of victims of police brutality. I mean, it had all the names, you know, that you would recognize. Eric Gardner, Tamir Rice, Freddie Gray, Sandra Bland. And it went on and on and on. And you know, Randy Moss afterwards said, this is a way of me making a statement and letting them know that they're not alone, and that at a big event where I have a big platform like this, I'm not going to forget.
Well, we actually have him explaining just that. Here's Randy Moss.
By these names on my tie, at a big platform as the Pro Football Hall of Fame, there's a lot of stuff going on in our country. And I just want to let these family members know that they're not alone.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting to me because it's not the first time a professional player, has used clothing. Let's not forget LeBron James had the I Can't Breathe t-shirt that he warmed up in prior to a game. You're going to start seeing, I think, because Trump has made such a big deal with the anthem protest and the kneeling, players trying to find creative ways to raise their voice, to make a political point, or just to make a social justice point. And it's going to be interesting to see throughout this NFL season, but also I think throughout the NBA season and other professional athletes, how they handle this and how creative they get in terms of sending a message. I thought this was a fantastic way to send a message, and it's got a lot of people talking. I hope it gets more people talking.
Yeah. Well, you know, we all tend to talk about men's sports a lot, so I'm going to go
too
over,
much.
I'm going to go over time here because I just want to ask you one question at least about this really interesting story coming out of the WNBA. For the first time in WNBA history, the Las Vegas Aces, the team,
love them.
Did I get that right?
Yes.
They forfeited
team,
a game.
Yeah, they forfeited a game. So, yeah, they had to travel to Washington, D.C. for a game. And because of flight delays and cancellations, it actually took them 26 hours to get from Las Vegas to D.C. And they arrived, I believe it was 4 hours before tip-off, having not slept, having been up all night. And they were, like, requesting from the league, do something. And all the league was going to do is, I believe, push the tip-off back an
hour.
Were
they taking, like, commercial flights?
They were taking commercial flights. This is something that would not have happened in the NBA because they take charter flights. And listen, this is sort of – and they basically – the players basically said, you know, we don't want to risk our health. You know, when you're fatigued, it's a higher risk of injury. We're not going to play. The league ruled that this would be deemed a forfeit. It may eventually cost the Las Vegas Aces a spot in the playoffs. That's the incident. I think the bigger message, the bigger picture here is female athletes, female pro athletes deserve respect as female pro athletes.
And full stop.
Full stop. I mean, there's no halfway. You can't have them taking commercial flights, flying 26 hours, and then expect them to play. And there's going to be some reckoning, I think, in the upcoming collective bargaining agreement negotiations that they need more respect as athletes.
Well, WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer walking us through this week's sports segment on Radio Boston. Thank you so very much, Shira.
You're very welcome, Meghna.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A little over a week ago, Greg Scommell, the senior scientist at the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries, he was standing at the bow of a research boat as it closed in on a great white shark in the waters off Wellfleet. Now, he was there studying the local shark population because, I should say, Scommell is the shark guy for Massachusetts. But this time, something unexpected happened. A great white jumped right out of the water, right underneath him. And this video has been everywhere, but in case you haven't seen it, the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy posted a video of the encounter this week, and here's a bit.
I think I see him there.
Right off the... We're right at Greg there now in that
bunker. Whoa! Holy crap! It dove right out of the water!
You see that?
Man!
Did you see that?
Oh my God, did you see that? Greg Scommell leapt back when the great white jumped up. Now, you really have to watch this video. The audio doesn't quite do it justice. So go to radioboston.org and we've got a link to it. And joining us now on the line from New Bedford is Greg Scommell himself. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, it's great to be back.
It is great to have you. Let me just ask you the first obvious question. I mean, you're the shark guy. I would think that nothing phases you about great whites, but you did jump.
Yeah, I did a little two-step there, and my wife didn't know I could move my feet that fast. It was startling, to say the least. I was really surprised by what happened last Monday.
Yeah, and so, I mean, you had a stick with a GoPro on it, right? Were you trying to film the shark?
Yeah, what we do, now we've been doing this all summer, we've been doing it the last five summers, and we go up to each individual white shark that's identified by our pilot in the air, and then we do a few sweeps of the GoPro to determine if it's a male, a female, you know, individual markings, do we know this shark, and then if the shark cooperates, we put a tag in it, and so this is our standard operating procedure. So this particular shark was swimming in incredibly murky water, and I could not see it. Normally we can identify the shark from 20, 30, 40 feet away. This one, I'm looking down, thinking, where is it? And there it is. Boom. jumps right up to the pulpit where I'm standing, and I look down, and I'm looking right down the throat of a gaping white shark. And I got to say, that's it's not the most comfortable position to be in.
Well, respect to Mother Nature, right?
Absolutely,
red in
yeah.
teeth and claw. I mean, so, you know, anyone who's watched shark specials on TV, we've seen images of sharks jumping, but usually it's because there's bait hanging over their head. So is this jumping behavior typical for them?
You know, it's very typical in other parts of the world, namely South Africa, where they're usually feeding on seals near the surface. And so when they strike the seal, it carries their body out of the water and they're breaching. Here in Cape Cod, Massachusetts area, we don't see them breach very often. We've seen, this is the third breaching event we've seen. One was associated with attacking a seal. And then this one, you know, I hope it wasn't associated with attacking me, but it really does lead me to speculate as to why this shark reacted in that way.
Right. It's so fascinating. So it's only the third time you've seen this on the...
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You know, we've been out there for the last 10 years tagging these sharks, and I've only seen three breaches, and this one seemed to be directed at me.
Wow. I mean, you've studied shark behavior for a long time. Could it be, this is speculation, I know, but could it be because, I mean, the GoPro at the end of the stick, could that have resembled something that looked like prey?
Well, I had the GoPro and the stick horizontal and up. It wasn't down in the water. And so I'm thinking it's one of two things, or maybe a combination of both. We spooked that shark, you know, in that turbid water. The shark couldn't see us. It was hunting seals. We spooked it, and it just reacted by jumping and getting out of our way. That's entirely possible. The other option is that the shark was swimming along hunting seals, turbid water, and sees my movement, my reflection, my image, something that triggered a predatory response, because the shark's mouth was wide open, and we typically don't see that if the shark's not trying to feed.
I see.
And so it lunged up at me and then, you know, faded back into the water and swam off. I did not get any GoPro footage of it. We did not tag it. It was all, you know, 2 seconds in my life that passed incredibly quickly.
2 seconds, which I'm gathering you're not likely to forget anytime soon.
No.
But, Greg, let me ask you... We've had a bunch of shark sightings this summer. I think people might remember there was that amazing image of a shark passing underneath a paddle boarder a little earlier this summer. Mm. And then just on mm-hmm. Monday, Plymouth and Wellfleet beaches were closed to swimmers because of sightings. Yesterday, mm-hmm. the head of the Meadow Beach and Coast Guard Beach were also closed. Are there more sightings or unusually a large number of sightings this year?
Well, yeah, what we're doing is we're getting raw numbers, and we don't have the analysis complete because it takes quite a bit of time, but we've been doing this for several years. And what I can say is that July of this year, 2018, has been far more populated with sharks than in previous years. So we had a very strong July. August is shaping up to be a very typical August with lots of white sharks. And they're pervasive throughout state waters, and they're close to shore. And we've seen them close to shore consistently for many years. They're here to hunt seals. And there's lots, because this summer has been so warm, there's more and more people going to the beach. There's more and more people with cameras. You know, people are aware of these animals. We want that. We want people to be aware of them. We want them to respect them. And we're getting lots and lots of reports. So, yeah, it's a little bit more this year than in previous years, but it's also potentially an artifact of just the sheer numbers of people that are out.
I see. So just a big overlap with the sharks being here and people being on the water as well. But we were looking at a 2017 study in the journal Bioscience that was talking about the growing seal population in southeastern Massachusetts, that there could be something like 50,000 seals there. I mean, certainly, is that a driving factor in bringing more sharks into the area?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So if we look at the history of the seals, you know, we had driven them to the brink of extinction over time, and it's only over the course of the last 40-plus years that they have rebounded thanks to protections we've put in place back in the 1970s. So with that growing seal population, white sharks, which are top predators of seals, are taking notice, and they're moving closer to shore where these seals are amassing in big numbers. And they're doing what they used to do. They come close to shore. They feed on seals. They take advantage of this feeding opportunity. And, of course, over the course of time, you know, we have populated these beaches as well. So we have this you know, the synergy of three top species all in one area. And it can create problems, at least in terms of perception.
Yeah. You know, sharks are these powerful, absolutely beautiful, prehistoric creatures that have not been treated very well by humankind, I should say. But with these increased sightings and potential interactions in a summer like this one, I mean, what's your message to swimmers, beachgoers, surfers, boaters? You know, what should they be looking out for and what should they do?
Well, you know, something we've been trying to do for the last several years, you know, working with the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy, my agency, Marine Fisheries, as well as National Park Service and all the towns, is simply get the word out, educate the public that these are animals that are going to be here for the summer months into the fall, and we have to modify our behavior so as to minimize the potential for any kind of negative interactions between the two species. In other words, we want swimmers and folks who recreate on the water to stay close to shore. We want them to stay away from seals. We don't want them to swim alone. Really common sense, you know, kinds of actions that will, you know, reduce that probability. Yeah. You know, the bottom line is there hasn't been a fatal shark attack in Massachusetts since 1936,
yeah.
And we really don't want to see that change.
Right.
But with all these white sharks around, people need to be cognizant of that, and we need to modify our behavior.
Well, Greg Skomal is a senior scientist with the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries, still has adrenaline pumping through his veins from his close encounter
yeah.
last week. Greg, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. It's nice to chat with you.
That's it for today. This is Radio Boston.